Welcome to Post Carbon Radio. I'm your host for this segment, Karin Nyhus. Today we're going to talk about Africa and a new initiative for Pan-African unity in the 21st century. This initiative, called Africans Rising, centers African women, children, youth, and the environment, including climate change and its impacts, as well as the natural resources of the continent. These topics are all huge, of course, but today we have a very special guest uniquely qualified to explain how they intersect not only as problems, but also in a new vision and project for social, environmental, and climate justice on the African continent and the African diaspora. I'm very pleased and honored to be joined by Kumi Naidoo. Kumi Naidoo is a South African human rights activist who most recently directed Greenpeace International for nearly a decade. He has battled apartheid in his native South Africa and poverty as well, and led the global call for climate action. Now he's helping launch a major initiative named Africans Rising. Thank you for taking time out of your busy travel schedule to be with us, and welcome to Post Carbon Radio, Kumi Naidoo.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So I've listed some of the issues involved in Africans Rising, but how would you put it? Well, what is Africans Rising?
So first, Africans Rising is an effort to unite the peoples across the continent with the vision of organizing from below and beyond borders. We believe that the future of Africa is going to be best served by the maximum level of social, economic, and political integration that we can muster. However, we believe that there are several challenges facing the continent which are within the domain of control of our own leaders, and we want to organize ourselves to bring those demands more strongly to address the poor level of governance that we have on the continent. But also we recognize that some of the issues that we face, such as illicit financial flows, where money leaves the continent in huge quantities, is in fact something that's related to the global system and how the global system works. So for certain demands, we have to stand shoulder to shoulder with our own governments and push at the global level. But we believe that there is no reason why our governments can't address gender equality, democracy, human rights, and so on, much as we believe that the narrative of slavery and colonialism is an important one. We do not believe that we can continue to blame everything simply on that reality. We have to be respectful of history on the one end, but we also have to move on. And for some of the failures that we see on the part of our own governments, you cannot blame history and colonialism for.
So who helped form Africans Rising, and when and where did you start?
So the initiative was started by coming together of a few networks which I wasn't part of. It was October 2015, the African Trade Union Congress, the African Religious Leaders Council, the Pan-African Climate Justice Alliance, some of the regional NGO coordinating bodies. And what was behind the idea was to try to look at how do we change the narrative of Africa as well. Our starting point is not that Africa is a poor continent. In fact, our starting point is that Africa is the richest continent underneath the ground. And we would argue that precisely for that reason, we are one of the poorest continents above the ground, what some academics call the resource curse. And we want to start from a basis that our continent is a very resilient one. The fact that we've had to survive the ravages of slavery, colonialism during the Cold War being kicked around as a political football and so on. Our starting point is that Africa is rich in culture, rich in resilience, rich in resources and so on. And we want to change the narrative of how Africa is spoken about. And we consciously call it Africans Rising because there was a narrative for the last 10 years about Africa rising, coming out of the World Bank and other mainstream media organizations. And what was behind Africa Rising was all about GDP growth. So we had GDP rise, but in fact, the people of Africa are sinking more and more with regard to us having to deal now with the impacts of climate change, deepening inequality, and so on.
I think Americans listening to you are going to resonate with that comment if they understand that 90% of the growth that's happened since the 2008 crash has gone to the top 1% in this country. And we'll get to that. I think we have some lessons to learn from Africans Rising. You were officially launching on African Liberation Day this Thursday, May 25th. Tell us about African Liberation Day, which you didn't invent, right? Why is that symbolic and appropriate as a launch date for Africans Rising?
Well, firstly, it's important to note that neither the African Union nor any individual African country government promotes African Liberation Day with any measure of enthusiasm. The answer for that is quite simple, and that is many of the citizens of many countries would say, what liberation and what freedom are you talking about? This is an attempt of us building on a legacy of a day that was declared by the Organization of African Unity and proposed by Kwame Nkrumah decades ago. And we wanted to remember the people that laid down their lives for our liberation from colonialism, apartheid, and other human rights violations. And we basically wanting to remind our leaders today that the levels of sacrifice that we ask of them is significantly less than what we ask of an early generation of leaders. We're not asking them to go to prison for 27 years as we asked of Nelson Mandela. We're not asking them to lay down their lives as many did in the anti-colonial struggles. We're asking them to be clean, do not steal, govern with integrity and accountability. So this diversity of organizations coming together is also quite important because normally on the continent and globally, NGOs, trade unions, and faith organizations do not work as closely as ideally we would like to see them work.
Yes, it's a very broad coalition you've brought together. You've also published a vision statement, and we will be highlighting some points from that shortly. But first, I wanted to connect to what you said about the Organization of African Unity, also now known as the African Union, and again, the United States, because we're just passing Malcolm X's birthday on May 19th here in the United States. He was born in 1925. And of course, back in 1963, when the OAU was formed, Malcolm was very aware of that and immediately went on to establish the Organization of African American Unity, which of course won him an invite to the second meeting of the OAU in 1964. Kumi, do you want to comment on these past connections in Pan-Africanism to the United States and how that resonates now?
Yes. I mean, the Kilimanjaro Declaration, which was adopted as the founding document of African Rising in August last year in Tanzania, very strongly makes a commitment and expresses the intention of working together with our brothers and sisters in the African diaspora, whether they were taken during the slavery period, whether they were there as exiles from political repression, or whether they are out in the world as a result of economic migration. Irrespective of the reason, we say that our brothers and sisters in the diaspora are very much part of this movement. The truth is that if we didn't have the monthly modest amounts of money coming to families in Africa, which are called remittances, millions of families would literally starve on the African continent. To play a big role in that way. But more importantly, they care about Africa, their families are there, and we want them to be able to contribute their skills and knowledge on an ongoing basis. And so in that context, there is a connection with the struggles of folks who live in different parts of the world, including in the United States. And I'm very happy to say that various organizations in the United States are actually participating in the launch. I know there'll be activities in Oakland organized by the African Priorities Network, for example. Very much there is a continuity with the earlier struggles, and we want to make those connections strongly. And we hope that our voices of solidarity from the continent when people in the diaspora face challenges will add value and vice versa.
One of the things I see in your initiative is a new vision of leadership itself and leadership development. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Our continent is the most youthful continent. Sadly, though, our leadership does not reflect that demography. And part of what we say in the Kilimanjaro Declaration is that we must put young people in the center of public life. That it's inadequate any longer to simply say young people are the leaders of tomorrow, when in fact we look at our adult leadership today in the political and business sphere, and we see that they've actually run out of fresh ideas, that, you know, they're making the mistake that Albert Einstein warned us about, you know, when Einstein said the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting to get different results. So we need young people's fresh perspectives. They are going to pay the bigger price for whatever decisions are made or not made and whatever actions are taken or not taken. And so in that sense, we are very committed to the idea of building strong leadership and creating opportunities for young people to lead. So therefore, for example, full-time coordinator that will take over is a brilliant young Gambian activist who was quite central to the peaceful overthrow of the long-standing dictator Yahya Jammeh in Gambia recently, and Mohamed Lamine Sadikin. And he is one out of many, many young people on the continent who bring different ways of organizing on how to use social media, about what kind of Africa they want, and so on. So that's one very different leadership approach. The other thing is, we're saying, you know, we can't build this like any other conventional movement. We're trying something different here. We want to build what we call a leader-full organization, by which we mean that there will be a few of us playing the role of facilitation and catalyzing and so on. But we want people to sign up to the Kilimanjaro Declaration, whether they're in the diaspora or whether they're on the continent, and for them to own this movement and organize under that message in wherever they find themselves and however difficult circumstances they might find themselves anywhere on the continent.
One statement in your opening vision statement is, quote, in Africa we act as 54 separate countries. How and why is that a problem, and what is Africans Rising trying to do about that?
Well, firstly, we must recognize that the boundaries of the nation states that we have today do not make economic, linguistic, cultural, or environmental or any other sense. In fact, it probably never made any sense whatsoever. These were boundaries that were drawn within a colonial mindset. And, you know, if you look at some of our countries, we have very straight boundaries, for example, because these were arbitrarily drawn at a conference in Berlin as part of the carving up of Africa. So that history is there. And what we're saying is, you know, obviously we can't walk away from that history. We operate within a system of nation states. But we need to recognize that we also are dealing with a very complex global system. And the reason why, you know, with all its challenges, the European Union have made an effort at integration and unity is precisely because they know they cannot stand in the global stage in the face of the power that, you know, United States or China or even India represent. That, you know, in global negotiations, whether it's about finance, trade, climate, whatever, Africa's chances are best served by maximizing our unity. And for that reason, we are saying, you know, even in terms of our development strategies, might very well be, let me give you an example, that one country on its own might not be able to put up a big solar plant to bring energy access to people who have not had it in most rural areas in Africa, for example. But if a country shares a boundary with two other nations, for example, there's no reason why they cannot come together in a joint partnership and do one big concentrated solar plant on a border area where it might intersect with two or three countries, so that that becomes more feasible in terms of costs and so on. So the other thing, you know, when we look at the restrictions to intra-African trade, we cannot blame the global system for that. Our leaders must just get their act together and enable people on the continent to trade more freely. There are far too many restrictions to intra-African trade, for example, and these are the kinds of things that we would like to see coming from greater sense of unity and integration, and less of a view that each African country can somehow magically make it on its own. They just have to do better on their own. I think even if we had heads of state of every African country who were very efficient and smart and not corrupt and so on, they still won't succeed because there are many African economies, for example, are far too small to be able to compete competitively on the kind of unjust global economy we have today.
So you mentioned climate change, and you write about already experiencing significant impacts from climate change on the continent. Can you talk about some of the realities that climate change is bringing to Africa as we speak?
Well, what we are seeing is climate intensified drought and climate intensified desertification that is happening in certain parts of Africa. We can say, for example, even the genocide in Darfur was the first climate-induced resource war brought about as a result of water scarcity and land scarcity, then giving you the toxic sort of mix of food scarcity. The images of people who are desperately risking everything to get into Europe, you know, it's economic migration infused by climate refugees. There's no question about that. We are seeing also land where people were able to grow food and now not being able to do so because of the soil quality being damaged. We are seeing drought, which has impacted already on agriculture in my part of Africa, southern Africa. We have seen major disruptions to agriculture as a result of climate-intensified drought. And climate scientists warn us about drought in southern Africa. So it's not as if climate impacts is something that's going to hit us in the future. It is with us now, and it's quite unjust and it's quite unfair because the African continent as a whole, South Africa being an exception, I should say, but the African continent as a whole has been least culpable in terms of historical emissions, but the people of Africa are paying the first and the most brutal price in terms of climate impacts already. And there is no question in my mind that the rise in levels of conflict and the fact that conflict is thriving in many parts of the continent at the moment, whether whichever shape or form it takes, the fact that resources, particularly water, land, and food, are being constrained is no question in my mind a contributory factor to the rising levels of conflict we've seen already on the continent.
Yes, your vision statement for African Rising says it's working to promote a humane and compassionate response. Tell us about what mistakes and pitfalls from the past you're trying to prevent in that response.
Well, when we talk about a compassionate response, we have to recognize that there's going to be movements of people across the continent as a result of climate impacts because the global system as well as our own leaders left it for too late. Okay, so already we are seeing climate impacts and we need to respond to it in compassionate terms, in terms of how countries where things are not so bad are able to receive people who are moving because basically land and water has dried up. Secondly, we are saying that we can turn the crisis of climate change into an opportunity, given that the continent is blessed with amazing levels of renewable energy resources. We're not just talking solar, wind, we're talking geothermal, we're talking biomass, we're talking wave energy and so on. So we have tremendous potential on the continent. It's whether we can actually plan and execute an energy revolution from an economy that's dependent on dirty brown fossil fuel, climate-destroying energy, and whether we can transition to an economy that's driven by clean, green, renewable energy. If we were to do that on scale with the ambition and so on, not only do we have a good solution in terms of, you know, meeting our climate obligations, we can also turn it into a jobs bonanza and also jobs where people's lives are not at risk and where people are not working in difficult conditions. I'm yet to meet a coal miner who says, my ambition for my child is I want my child to be a coal miner. You know, yes, people are dependent on coal jobs, but these are jobs that have huge implications in terms of health for the people who work in those industries, respiratory illnesses particularly, as well as those that live around them. And that's proven now beyond any doubt. So we want to take an optimistic approach that we can actually start engaging in a massive energy revolution that includes also the energy efficiency side of things, which is, you know, having a boost in the construction industry where we start retrofitting our buildings so that they are more energy efficient and require, you know, less electricity to either warm or cool them down. So, you know, it's not as if our starting point is all gloom and doom. Things are challenging and things are horrific for many people on the continent, but there's enough creativity. Young people are geared up, I believe, to play their part, and those of us who have not delivered the solutions over a long period of time must now, you know, create the basis for young people to lead and to do it in a way where we start experimenting with very different ways of organizing society, from our energy systems, our economy, and so on.
One key topic you discuss in your vision statement is the question of civil society, what it is, and how it's not necessarily the same thing as an NGO or a nonprofit organization. Why is this important to understand as you move forward with Africans Rising?
Well, firstly, the term civil society is a much broader term than just nonprofit, NGO, and so on. But in many countries, in the last 20 years, the term civil society has been more generally equated with NGOs and trade and nonprofits. But if we are going to maximize the citizen engagement and get people to become more active and to take care about their children's future and become active, you know, citizens, including being willing at times to engage in civil disobedience if that's what the situation calls for, you need to have the broadest usage and an application of the term civil society, which includes trade unions, it includes religious institutions, faith-based organizations, social movements, informal groups, and so on. And so we are taking a more inclusive definition of civil society because we believe that the maximum level of citizen unity is what it will take to push for the kinds of big structural and systemic changes that we feel are necessary to ensure that the people on the continent finally get some real sense of liberation and freedom, which we do not believe we have really enjoyed since the formal acquisition of liberation post-colonialism.
What role do you see technology playing in Africans Rising? What role do you hope it plays?
Well, technology has been critical in terms of mobilizing. We've consciously did this very much on a voluntary basis and so on. What we have is, people sometimes forget that the Arab resistance authoritarian rule started on the African continent in Tunisia and moved to Egypt and so on. And the use of technology there was amazing. You know, people said, we use Facebook to organize our peaceful protests. We use Twitter to tell people where to go, when to go, and so on. And then we use YouTube to tell the world this is what we did, you know. And so people of my generation can be called digital immigrants, and people of the younger generation can be called digital natives. You know, it comes more kind of naturally and so on. So I think that technology offers a lot of possibilities of organizing. I mean, sometimes when I sit down with some of my comrades from the anti-apartheid movement from my days as a student leader, we sometimes, you know, talk about the old days and we say, imagine how different our struggle would have been if there were cell phones and SMSs and WhatsApp and Facebook and so on. It would be different, you know. But having said that, one must be careful not to see social media as a panacea, and that social media can be a replacement for actual organizing on the ground in the conventional sense. So yes, online organizing and online capability allows us more reach and more creativity and innovation and so on. But it cannot be a replacement for conventional mobilization and organizing and, you know, getting people to be able to convene in ways that send a message to those in power that people want significant change.
Well, speaking of YouTube, I was looking at some YouTubes about African Liberation Day in the United States, which, as you mentioned, is a very international event. And one of the slogans I saw was African youth organizing against all settler and neocolonial regimes from DRC Congo to Standing Rock and Palestine. For me, that really brings it home to issues that resonate with people who don't necessarily feel connected to Africa here in the United States, because colonialism was and is global, right?
I think it's very encouraging to see the kind of connections that young people are making across different parts of the world, united by mainly a sense of injustice that they are facing, even though the context might be different, but feeling that, they need to come together, and that coming together and that unity is mutually beneficial. Now, you know, it's not surprising to me that it's young people that are taking the lead in this, because it is young people who are going to pay the biggest price for the absence of leadership and political will to address, for example, the ravages of climate change that is already on our doorstep. We are 5 minutes to midnight in terms of that point which scientists call you know, catastrophic, runaway, irreversible climate change. And our leaders are in denial about how close we are to a danger that doesn't, you know, threaten the planet. You know, I upset people sometimes when I say, you know, the planet does not need saving because of the consequences of us not making the changes to secure the future of our children and their children is that we don't get off dirty energy quickly, stop destroying our forests, start taking care of our oceans and so on. The end result would be that we will be gone as a species when, you know, soil gets destroyed, water sources dry up, we can't produce enough food and so on. We will be gone as a species. It should be said, once humanity becomes extinct as a species, the oceans will recover, the forests will grow back and so on. People need to understand that the struggle to avert catastrophic climate change is fundamentally about whether humanity can fashion a way to coexist in a mutually interdependent relationship with nature for centuries and centuries to come. Put differently, the struggle is fundamentally about protecting our children and their children's futures. And therefore, I think that young people are presenting ideas and visions of different ways, and rather than be terrified by it, given that what we have tried to create a sustainable and just world has largely been unsuccessful, we should step back and allow new ideas to emerge. Because if we're brutally honest, right now we don't really have a plan. The Paris Agreement only gets us so far. It isn't a foolproof plan by far, and there is much more ambition and courage and political will that needs to be mustered if we are to put the planet on a safe course. And sadly, when it's not coming from leaders, then movements like what we're building, African Rising for Justice, Peace and Dignity, has to step forward, provide an alternative perspective, which is what we're planning to do.
As we need to move to wrap up, I want to ask how people can learn more about Africans Rising and the Kilimanjaro Declaration.
So, you know, we just encourage people to visit the Africans Rising website, africans-rising.org. And first, we encourage people to read the Kilimanjaro Declaration, which is a very short one-page vision of what we're trying to do. And we ask people to join, sign the declaration if they support the vision. And then once they do that, they will be receiving updates and suggestions for activities and so on. But the main message, you know, what people should see Africans Rising as is just a framework for us to unite. This idea, time has come. We've been talking about it for a long time now. And we hope that people start getting serious about unity, because unity is the only durable weapon we have to advance the interests of the people on the African continent.
Our guest has been Kumi Naidoo, former director of Greenpeace International and now leading organizer and proponent of Africans Rising, which you can visit on the web at africans-rising.org. Kumi Naidoo, thank you so much for being on Post Carbon Radio.
Thank you for having us.